Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Luke's English Podcast is made possible thanks to support from my sponsors and also donations from listeners. If you would like to support the show with a donation, you can do it via PayPal. Just click one of the donate buttons that you'll see on the website. You can also send me a direct bank transfer too, if PayPal isn't supported in your country for some reason. The details for that are on my website. In the menu, you'll see an item that says Luke, and there's a drop-down menu from that, and you need to click Support Luke. And that's where you can get the details for doing a bank transfer. If you have sent me a donation recently, I would like to say a very special thank you to you. You are keeping this podcast alive, and I see it as the most sincere way that you can thank me for my efforts in providing this free podcast for learners of English. Sponsorship for this episode comes from iTalki, and that's a service that I think is a great companion to this podcast. With iTalki, you can get the speaking practice or English tutoring that you need by connecting with native speakers and qualified teachers online through Skype. You go onto iTalki, you create your profile, and then you check out the different teachers that they have. You can see little videos so that you can get an introduction to them. You can have a trial lesson with them. And ultimately, when you found the teacher that you prefer, you can then organize lessons based on your own schedule. You can set your own learning aims, and then you can have lessons or conversations pretty much anywhere that you have an internet connection. To get a free lesson with iTalki, go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello. This is Luke's English Podcast, episode number 520, which is called Idioms, Game and Chat with Andy Johnson, plus 18 more idioms and vocab items explained. And in this episode, you can continue to listen to a conversation that I recorded with Andy Johnson just the other day. The language focus in this double episode is on idiomatic expressions. In fact, we're playing a sort of idioms game. The rules of the game are that before having the conversation, Andy and I had to prepare three idioms each. And by prepare, I mean just to just think of three idioms or flick through an idioms dictionary and pick three idioms that you like, any three idioms. And then during the conversation, we had to try and insert the idioms naturally without drawing too much attention to them. Just slip them into the conversation naturally. That was the challenge. And then we both, at the end of the conversation, have to try and identify which expressions the other one had prepared in advance. Okay? So try and use three idioms that you've prepared in advance, and then try and guess the three idioms that the other one was using. That's what we're doing in this exercise. During the whole conversation, lots of idioms just came up naturally. In part one, as you heard, if you have heard part one, which you should hear before you hear this one, in part one, I went through a lot of those idioms from part one. There were about 25 idioms in the first part, and I explained them all at the end. Do you remember all of those idioms? If you've heard part one, do you remember them all? Here's a quick reminder, very quickly. Here are some of the idioms from last time. So we had to bring someone up to speed, to have beef with someone, to hold a grudge against someone, to have a score to settle with someone, to jump the gun, to be the butt of the joke, bad blood between people, to take something on face value, to be a piece of cake, it's not my cup of tea, to hit the nail on the head, to stick out like a sore thumb, to shoehorn something in, to do something on the spur of the moment, to be on the doorstep of somewhere, to be two or three sheets to the wind, to be half cut, to creep out of the woodwork, to feel a bit peckish, to be jaw-dropping or eye-opening, to shine a spotlight on something or someone, to call someone out for doing something, and finally, to slag someone off. So those were some of the expressions that came up in part one. Again, I explained all of those at the end of part one. So if you haven't heard that yet, then go back and listen to the whole episode because you'll hear me explaining those things, giving examples and things. Only one of those idioms was actually prepared in advance. All the others just came up on the spur of the moment. So that means that in this episode, part two, there are still five more pre-prepared idioms left. And by the way, if you don't really understand the rules of the game, no, there's no problem. Just listen out for, you know, just enjoy the conversation and then also listen out for certain idiomatic phrases or just nice bits of vocabulary that will be explained later. So, having checked part two, this is the conversation you're going to listen to here. Having checked it, I can tell you that there are about 18 idioms in total in this one. So listen carefully to the rest of our conversation and try to spot expressions which you think might be the idioms that I will be defining later. Five of them were written down by us in advance and slipped into the conversation as part of the game. The others just happened naturally. There's also plenty more nice, useful vocab that you might not know coming up. So listen carefully. There's a lot to learn from this episode. In terms of the topics in the conversation, well, in this one you'll hear us cover Andy's experience of being abused or angrily criticised on Twitter, all part of a misunderstanding. We talk about my experiences of facing audiences as a stand-up comedian. We talk about how there's another Andy Johnson in London who also looks a bit like Moby in a way and who used to play football for England. That's another Andy Johnson. We talk about Andy's training for the upcoming London Marathon and the fact that he's being sponsored and he's giving the money away to a charity which is very close to his heart. And also we then talk about the results of the idioms game. We kind of count the idioms at the end and give our comments about the idioms that we noticed or didn't notice and the ones that the other one was using. As I said, I'll also be explaining all the idioms and more vocabulary at the end of the conversation in the final part of this episode. So keep listening for some clarification of things that you might not have understood or noticed. But now then, let's carry on with the conversation and hear about Andy's experience of facing criticism on Twitter because of a misunderstanding about his presentation about millennials in the workplace. And by the way, if you're thinking, wait a minute, millennials in the workplace? What is that? Or millennials in the workplace? That sounds interesting. For more information about Andy's talk on millennials, which he did at the IATEFL conference and a few other places, for more information about that and to find out indeed what millennials are, if you don't know, then let me recommend that you listen to episode 424 of this podcast, in which I spoke to Andy and his colleague Ben about that whole subject in more detail. And you can find the link for episode 424 on the page for this episode with all the other notes and stuff, all the vocab notes and things, or you can just find it in the episode archive. Okay, right then. So without any further ado, let's jump back into the conversation and here we go.
Did I tell you I got Twitter abused as well?
You mentioned it to me, but I didn't hear the full story. So you got abused on Twitter, did you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it wasn't my fault. What happened is I was doing at the end of January, I was speaking at a conference on for English UK. Mm. And I was doing this millennials workshop that I think I've spoken about before on the podcast. And before I started, this guy came up to me and he said, "Do you mind if I live tweet your talk?"
Live tweet.
Yeah. So it's quite common at conferences. So when people are giving a talk, you've got people going, "Andy Johnson just said this," and they put it on Twitter.
Yeah.
And according to Andy Johnson, and then I don't know why they do, but they do it. And this guy was from CUP, Cambridge University Press. Mm. So I was like, yeah, of course, I don't mind. Anyway, so I give my talk. It went well. It was really well received. And then I looked on Twitter, I think the next day, And there was a tweet from this guy who was live tweeting me. And it said, there was a picture of me doing my talk. And it said, according to Andy Johnson, millennials are, and then he had like a list. He said, lazy, entitled, all these kinds of things. And then underneath it said, but the reasons are far more complex than that. Oh. So he wasn't like criticizing me. But what happened is a load of people read the tweet and said, who is this guy to slag off a whole generation? And it got really kind of heated.
Yeah.
And to be fair to the guy from Cambridge who was doing the tweeting in the first place, he was like, oh, no, I think you've misunderstood. He was actually explaining the reasons why they are perceived to be all these things, but he's explaining why they're actually not. But by this time, like, about 20 people are kind of got involved in the conversation, all of them slagging me off.
And they'd all got the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
But they're all slagging you off.
Kind of, yeah. What? Like, not some of them more directly than others. But a lot of people are saying, you know, all this stuff is proved to be a myth and all that kind of stuff. And others are like, who is this guy in the with the bald head who looks like Moby?
I didn't realize Moby was into the Tefl industry.
Yeah. So it was really eye-opening. It was like really kind of how quickly it can escalate, you know,
yeah.
And how people latch onto something and they can completely turn it and twist it and look at it a different way. So for a while, I was like public enemy number one in wow. in the industry. So it was really quite interesting. But
how did it feel to receive all that sort of heavy-handed criticism?
Well, it was initially it was quite shocking because you're like, oh God, what did I say? But then I realized what was going on, and I was really I sent the guy a message actually, the guy from Cambridge whose tweet caused all the kerfuffle. There's a word for you.
Yeah, all
that's
the, good all words. The
And I was like thanking him for kind of sticking up for me. And he was really apologetic that it had been taken in the wrong way. So at the time it was a little bit unsettling. But then, you know, then I thought, well, what is with these people who are sitting on a Saturday afternoon looking at Twitter and who are they to kind of criticize? I think it reflects more poorly on them. It says a lot more about them than it does about anyone else. And I think that's kind of the issue with Twitter. And it has a real issue with bullying and the fact that it's so anonymous that people can do it.
It's very dangerous because it's, first of all, it's sort of anonymous, or at least you wouldn't do that to someone's face because the normal social conventions dictate that you don't say such direct, you know, such direct things.
Yeah.
But online, on Twitter, people don't have that immediate kind of filter that prevents them from saying things that could be very hurtful and possibly even wrong, like in this case. And so they just, you know, the anger just takes over and they just write something. They also maybe think that it's inconsequential. They might think that just a little tweet doesn't really, it's not really going to make that much difference. It's just one little tweet in you know, the whole avalanche of tweets that you get on Twitter. So they don't feel much responsibility when they write those messages. But it's pretty shocking and surprising when you receive something like that. Probably doesn't feel like much when someone writes a very harsh comment like that, but it certainly has a big impact on you when you read it.
It's true because the thing about Twitter and things like that, if you're, let's compare it to Facebook, for example, or Instagram, if you're putting pictures of your family, your friends, your kids, then it's very clear that you want to share that with people and they, you know, no one's ever going to go, oh, what an ugly kid looks like a girl or anything like that. You know what I mean? You just wouldn't do that. But there's something about when you're talking about a professional topic that really gets people, they feel that they can pass judgment on you, and particularly in academia, particularly with teachers. And it's one of the worst things about the profession that you and I work in, is that there's always people who are quick to criticize your standpoint, your viewpoint. And I face this a lot when I speak at conferences, because I'm very much pro online learning, and I believe that it's the way our industry is going. I think there will always be a place for teachers. But the amount of suspicion that people like me are viewed with by traditional teachers who think that we're just out to take their jobs off them. And it's not like that at all.
Mm.
But there is something about this industry, I think, Luke, that you really, if you stand on a pedestal and you give your opinion on things and you talk about anything with any degree of knowledge behind it, you're always setting yourself up for people to have a go at you. And I'm just surprised that it hasn't happened to me sooner, to be honest, because what I talk about is quite, can make some people feel quite uncomfortable and feel a little bit vulnerable about their profession.
Yeah.
It's not designed to, but I'm just saying you can't really ignore what's going on in the world.
Because you're talking about change. And,
talking about change, and nobody likes change.
People often sort of react quite strongly to that, especially when it's posing some sort of threat to the status quo of their work.
Yeah,
especially, and in, you know, I suppose in teaching people, after a while they kind of feel like they understand what teaching is, and they want it to stay that way. And when new things come along, it's kind of sort of very inconvenient, you know, for many teachers who feel like they've got their system down, and then all these new things come along, like these developments in technology, which mean that it suddenly is all up in the air again. It takes you a while to like learn how to teach or to be confident as a teacher, and so people may feel like these new things are kind of taking, like pulling the rug from under them, you know, it's like pulling the rug from under their feet in a way.
You must experience a lot of this through stand-up as well, because stand-up's even worse. If you're standing on stage trying to make people laugh, you must occasionally get people who just think you're rubbish.
You mean like hecklers?
Yeah.
But actually not that much in France. It's slightly different here because the audience is usually 50% or more French. Mm. And so they don't, I think they don't really feel like they're in a position to shout something out at the comedian. It's not really in the culture, first of all. So heckling, meaning listeners, meaning like shouting something out when someone's speaking publicly and a member of the audience shouts something out. It happens a lot in stand-up comedy. It can happen in other situations too. Someone shouting something out, probably quite some sort of criticism. So heckling is really normal in stand-up in the UK and the USA, where you get, you know, it's often quite aggressive or hostile audiences. But in France, it's sort of less like that. There's more of a theatre feeling to comedy shows here. So they don't have stand-up in the same way that we do in the UK. And so French audiences, first of all, they probably wouldn't be that confident to do it in English, it being the second language. And secondly, it's just not really in the culture to shout something out at a comedian. And then you've got tourists or expats as well. It doesn't happen that much, actually. But I've had it in the UK where people have shouted out stuff. But you see, in the context of a comedy show, somehow it's different because the whole reason that you're up there is you're just trying to make the audience laugh. And if there's someone heckling you, then they're just being a dickhead, you know, and everyone in the room knows it. Unless you've said something that's really out of order. Unless you've made a joke about something that is obviously quite offensive, then most of the time people heckling are just sort of a bit drunk, or they forget that there's a whole other room full of people there. And what normally happens is they'll shout something and you can't hear it because you're in the middle of saying something, or, you know, you're up there and you get this muffled noise from somewhere in the room. And to be honest, as a comic, it's quite fun when something like that happens, because you're like, what was that? What did you say? Because you want to then explore what the person said and deal with it, and it could turn into something funny. And normally what happens is that you hear this kind of like that, and you say, what was that? And then nothing, they just disappear completely.
And actually, if you can go down a real rabbit hole with this kind of stuff, but you can Google comedians dealing with hecklers. And if we were talking about Richard Herring before, there's one video, you must have seen this one, where there's this guy who's so drunk and it goes on for ages and he basically ruins the whole show.
Yeah.
And in the end, he gets taken out. But the way Richard Herring deals with him is really quite funny. And there's another very good one with Stuart Lee. So when Luke and I were younger, I think at university, Stuart Lee and Richard Herring were a famous double act, or they were on TV quite a lot. And they've since split up, but they both have quite successful solo careers. But there's a really good video. You've probably seen it as well, Luke. I think it's a guy that's asking him to change his whole show, or he's that's how he's dealing with the heckler. Stuart Lee's like, well, you need to understand that I've written this whole routine, it goes on for 2 hours, and I'm afraid I can't create a bespoke version of it just to please you.
Yeah.
And he completely destroys this poor guy who was heckling him in the first
place.
What
I quite like about the way that Stuart Lee deals with a heckler. So the normal way that a comedian would deal with a heckler would be to kind of try and destroy them, to belittle them, to put them in their place and stuff. But Stuart Lee's approach is to be kind of really understanding.
Yeah.
And to be like, you know, just really trying to understand what the person's problem is, and just to be really understanding and to sort of say, look, you know, I understand your grievance, but there's really nothing that we can do about that, and I'm very sorry that you feel that way, but there's, you know, really the whole setup of this situation and this show just means that your problem, your grievance is not going to be solved. I'm really sorry that your evening has been spoiled. And trying to understand like the thought process behind this thoughtless heckle, because it's probably quite a thoughtless comment. Yeah. Someone just saying something, they're a bit drunk and they don't realize that it's a pointless thing to often to criticize someone's routine when it's you know, it's been thought through and created in advance.
And he starts saying as well, no, I appreciate you spent a lot of money to be here, but you know, I've got a wife and I've got children, and this is how I earn my living. It's just not financially possible for me to create individual one-to-one shows. It's very, very funny.
Yeah, he kind of really respectfully responds to the heckle, which is a new thing, really, because normally what comedians will do, someone like Jimmy Carr, for example, will sort of destroy the heckler. And the audience often goes along with it because the audience don't like the heckler, because they feel the heckler is sort of spoiling the show. And so often the comedian will use the power of the audience to take that person down. Yeah, okay. So Richard Herring raised £100,000 on Twitter. Just what? From asking, like, who actually gave him the money? Was it these guys who, when they realized they were wrong, they were like, oh, all right, fair enough. Okay, I'll donate some money. Like, guilty kind of guys who felt ashamed after they realized.
I think maybe some of it might have come from them. But really, once people realized that he was going to do this all day, they thought, yeah, I'll just give him 20 quid or something to support what he's doing. Mm. And I think he had about 7,000 people make donations.
Wow.
So he set up a Just Giving page. And so people can just make the donation really, really super quickly. And yeah, so it was £100,000. And once you add gift aid, it's £130,000.
Wow.
So it's quite amazing.
Gift aid, that's when the government subsidizes donations to charity, right?
Yeah. So the way, I mean, in the UK, gift aid, so I'm raising money at the moment for the London Marathon, and gift aid allows, if you're a UK taxpayer, then all of your donate, if you donate £10, then most of that goes to charity, but some of it is taxed. Mm. And this used to happen for years and years and years. And actually it was really quite unfair that if I want to donate £10 to a charity, that the whole £10 doesn't go to that charity. So 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the government introduced this thing called gift aid, whereby as long as you give a few extra personal details about yourself, then the whole donation goes to the charity, which is really, really good.
Mm, so, yeah, that is great. So you're raising money for the London Marathon. You're going to run the London Marathon then this year.
I am. Yeah, I am. Yeah, I've got myself a target of £2,000 to raise. Mm-hmm. I'm 42% there. So I've raised just under £1,000 so far. And it's interesting because I don't think, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I don't think that fundraising exists to the same level as it does in the UK in other parts of the world. And I'll tell you why, because when I was living in Sweden, they were completely not used to, I was raising money for, I went to China to do one of these charity treks along the Great Wall of China. And I was asking my Swedish friends to sponsor me. And they're like, are you a doctor? They didn't understand why I would go and do that. And I was like, no, it's just a cause that I believe in. And by doing this event that you can support me by raising money, then that's how, you know, that's how we get there. Mm. So I don't know what it's like in other countries. I don't know whether charity exists to the same level as it does in the UK. I don't know. What's it like in France?
Of course, people are charitable, but the thing is that we're talking about here is the culture of doing a sponsored thing. Fundraising by doing a sponsored thing. Like, for example, often it's running a marathon or doing some sort of personal challenge and advertising it on Facebook or with your friends and setting up a GoFundMe account. Would it be GoFundMe or Fundraiser? What's the name of it? Just Giving
is the one that I use.
Yeah,
It's the most popular one in the UK.
Very popular fundraising website, which allows people to collect money, which they can then give to charity. So there is a culture of doing this sort of thing in the UK, definitely. I don't see as much of that in France. Maybe it's just that I'm not aware of it, but I'm sure it is. I know that the French are actually very charitable people, and there's a lot of charity work that goes on and a lot of campaigning and things like that, but less of the kind of individual fundraising events that individuals would do, like, for example, running a marathon. But it's definitely something I see from the UK all the time. In my Facebook feed, there's always someone who's doing something and raising money for some kind of cause. So, yeah, I think it's very much part of the culture these days, these kinds of individual fundraising activities.
This idea of sponsoring somebody, there's always got to be some element of hardship involved.
Yeah, like a challenge.
Like a challenge, yeah. So, for example, doing a marathon or spending the whole day on Twitter correcting idiots, as Richard Herring did. And it's a difficult balance because, I mean, I've had people ask me for sponsorship so they can go and climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And I think, really, I'd like to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. That sounds like a nice little holiday. But I guess it is quite tough.
I think climbing Kilimanjaro is really tough.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. I think it's really hard. But the thing is that it costs quite a lot of money to go to Mount Kilimanjaro. I guess the elements are here that it should be something that genuinely raises money for a good cause and something that involves personal challenge and difficulty. And so I think the Kilimanjaro thing is that although there is challenge and difficulty in there, it also would involve a nice traveling experience to another country, which would probably be quite costly. Yeah, so the I think the ones that probably people will give money to without questioning it would be challenges, local challenges, like, for example, running a marathon in your hometown. So, right, when is it? April the something?
April the 22nd. I think that's just over a month away, so 4 weeks. Four weeks on Sunday it's going to be.
Ready?
I think so. I had an injury. My training went really well through the end of last year, through Christmas. And then I went on I ran at the beginning of January, did 30 kilometers, which was good. It was great. Felt good. And then the day after, my knee really began to hurt, and it got worse and worse and worse throughout the week. So I couldn't run for 5 weeks, had physio, had acupuncture.
Whoa, really?
Had ultrasound. The physio, actually, the guy I saw, he's just around the corner from me, he used to be the physiotherapist for Fulham Football Club.
Oh, really?
And Fulham had a famous footballer, used to play for England as well, called Andy Johnson.
That's right.
So when my name popped up, he thought, Is it the same guy? And then when I walked in, he kind of did a double take because Andy Johnson and I share physical similarities. We both look a bit like Moby. Getting back to Twitter, doesn't that footballer follow you, Luke?
Yeah, that's right. That was a really weird thing. So, yeah, so we're talking about the England footballer, Andy Johnson.
Yeah.
Who...
Not me.
Who's not you. Although he shares your name and he looks a little bit like you. So, yeah, he follows me on Twitter. So I was like a couple of years ago, I got a notification that someone had started following me on Twitter. I checked it out. It was Andy Johnson. I was like, oh, Andy's joined Twitter. I checked it out. It was Andy Johnson, the footballer.
Yeah.
He's a professional footballer, played for England. Why is he following me on Twitter?
It's weird, isn't it? Because
really
you and
weird.
I have done quite a lot of work together.
Yeah.
And you and I have we've presented together and that's been on Twitter. So whether he got sick of people, I don't know whether he kind of saw that there was this connection between you and I, and I think, he thought, oh, maybe I should follow that guy.
I think what it was is that maybe he's searched for himself in Twitter. Right, he's gone into Twitter and he's gone, oh, I'll see who's talking about me. And he searched for Andy Johnson. And I've come up a few times because I've tweeted with your name in my tweet a few times.
Yeah.
And there have been various connections, you know, on the World Wide Web between you and me. And so I've come up in his search results probably quite high because I've tweeted about Andy Johnson quite a lot. And so he's gone, oh, this guy is talking about me. I think I'll follow him.
Big fan.
Bit of a mover and shaker in the world of football, this Luke Thompson.
He's got a podcast about me.
Yeah.
You should do an Andy Johnson episode. You should get him on. Send him an email.
Yeah, maybe I should.
Interview him about his Fulham days. Ask him about his physio.
The other Andy Johnson. Okay. So anyway, all right. So you had an injury. What?
Where, an injury.
Sorry, where again?
So right knee,
okay.
Sort of. So what it is for the runners out there, because I know you've got a few runners who listen to you, you've got this thing called your IT band, and it's the big kind of thick muscle that runs down your thigh and across your knee. And what was happening is it was just tightening and tightening and tightening to the point where it was rubbing against my knee joint. So that's quite painful. So I had to have physio to loosen it out again. So I have to do, it's not something that's going to be completely healed until after the marathon and when I stop running for a while, but I can manage it with stretching and all that kind of stuff. But it took me out for 5 weeks. I couldn't run at all for 5 weeks.
Ooh.
I started again. I did a half marathon at the weekend. Did a half marathon at Hampton Court Palace on Sunday.
Nice.
In the snow and the wind. And it was freezing. It was so cold.
Not
it was fine when you were running. It was fine, but by the time I finished, 5 minutes after finishing, I just really began to shiver. Yeah. I remember I was talking to my friend Ian, who I did the race with, and we both got a coffee. And I was looking at him, and he was holding his coffee, and his hand was shaking so much that it was spilling all over him.
Oh God, really?
It was just that cold. It was horrible.
Wow.
So.
I guess the weather's going to be better by the time April comes around.
Fingers crossed.
So if you had an injury on your right knee, which is not completely healed, when it comes to actually running the marathon, isn't that going to cause you some trouble? Isn't because, you know, any little problem like that gets exacerbated when you're running a marathon, right?
It's
you worried about it?
Possibly. A little bit, yeah, a little bit. I mean, I'm more worried about the fact that I'm running 16 miles this weekend and then 20 miles the weekend after, because those are my last two long runs. And then if I get those two done, then I've got 3 weeks just to rest up a little bit and begin to taper the training down a bit ahead of the race. So as long as I get through those two okay, then I'll be, in a way, I don't mind if I get hurt on the day, because I'll finish the race, whatever, even if I have to walk it, I'll still do it. But I don't want to turn up on the day with an injury that's so bad that I can't run on it.
Right.
So I'm more concerned about the next 2 weeks, but it seems to be, touch wood, it seems to be okay.
Touch wood.
That wasn't one.
That wasn't one of the idioms. When you actually do the marathon, do you eat in the morning? Do you have a full slap up breakfast, or is it just like a banana to keep the wolf from the door?
Bit of porridge, banana, honey, that kind of stuff. But you just get really hungry when you're doing it. That's the worst thing.
So is it a full breakfast then to start? Because I'm just trying. Okay. I'm just thinking of running on a full stomach.
Well, the thing is, they say that you, as long as you give an hour before finishing breakfast and running, you're fine. But on the actual race day itself, you need to leave the house really early to get to the race, and then you've got to wait. So it's usually at least 2 hours after finishing breakfast before you start running. The challenge, I think, with the marathon is that you get hungry halfway through.
Yeah.
So what you need to have a bit of chocolate.
Yeah. Okay.
That kind of stuff.
Uh-huh. Little, like a bit of trail mix, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that stuff. Jelly babes are good.
Do you get nervous?
I will be. For the marathon, yeah, because it's such a big event. And I've only ever done one full marathon before. I've done loads and loads of half marathons. I don't really get nervous about those anymore. But it's that fear of the unknown. It's that fear of, you know, I know I can run 20 miles, but can I do the last six?
Yeah. What's it going to be like when you're 21 miles into it? What kind of condition will you be in?
Probably crying, you know.
They'll scrape you off the tarmac at the end of it, won't they? And what about adrenaline?
Yeah, that's one of the challenges as well, because one of the things about the marathon is it's such a good atmosphere and you have so many people cheering you, and like, because I'll have my name on my vest, everyone's actually saying your name as well, which is really cool. And I think the challenge is when you start, you just feel amazing and you just run really quickly. So the challenge is that you go out too fast, and then you after about 6-7 miles, 10 kilometers, you're knackered because you've just been going too fast. So I remember when I did the marathon last time, my first 2 miles were like at a stupid pace.
What, fast?
Too fast, yeah. Yeah, because everyone's in the same boat. They've trained for all this time and they start, and it's great, and the atmosphere and the music and the noise and the camaraderie of running together, everybody just goes off far too quickly.
Yeah.
So I've got to try and just make sure I shuffle along and go slowly. There's this thing in running called negative splits, where if you do your race... A perfect race is that you'll run every single mile at the same pace, every single kilometer at the same pace. But what you should really try and do is something called negative splits, so that your second half is faster than your first half. And it's really hard to do. It's really, really hard to do for all sorts of reasons. But that's what I'll be trying to do on the 22nd.
Okay. People listening might want to donate money to support you on this.
Okay.
Is that all right? Is that okay by you?
That would be very, very welcome. If anybody wants to sponsor me, I can send you the link.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you went to justgiving.com and typed in my name, I think you'll probably find a bunch of Andy Johnsons. But if I send you my...
The footballer, link, probably, he's probably doing something, isn't he?
He's probably running the marathon, isn't he? Yeah.
But yeah, send me your link for Just Giving. And if it's, I might have some listeners who are up for supporting you. Can I ask what the charity is that you're going to give the money to?
Yep.
The Andy Johnson Foundation.
Yeah, my holiday fund. No, the charity is something that's very close to my heart. It's a hospital called the Christie.
Mm.
It's in Manchester where I grew up. And it's Europe's leading research center into cancer and treatments for cancer, and ultimately finding cures for cancer. And it's when I was sick, when I was 21, that's where I had all of my treatment. And it's an amazing, amazing place. And without going over a story that I've already told, it was, if it weren't for the doctors there, and the kind of approach they take, I probably wouldn't be alive, and I certainly wouldn't have my leg, because my cancer was so rare that it was so rare and so advanced that they had to really put me onto a very experimental course of treatment. And I'm very aware that had I been in another part of the world, even in another part of the country, I may not have had such good treatment. So this is the fourth or the fifth time I've raised money for them. It's something that I will do for the rest of my life. I'll always raise money for them. So yeah, so that's the Christie in Manchester. Amazing, amazing place.
Mm, okay.
So if you do want to sponsor me, that would be wonderful. All the money will go to them.
It's on justgiving.com, I think.
.com,
justgiving.com. But otherwise, there'll be... listeners, you'll find the link on the page for this episode on my website. And if you want to, you can throw some money in Andy's direction, which will help to support the Christie Hospital, which obviously is doing really, really great work and very important stuff. All right, mate. Well, good luck, basically. Is good luck the right thing to say? Is it a question of luck?
Yeah, it is.
Is luck involved in this?
I think so. I mean, the main thing I'm worried about is hurting myself. So if I don't hurt myself, then I'll consider that good fortune, good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, whatever you do, it's common that in England, this is a free idiom. It's not one of my idioms, but you say, when you're wishing someone luck, you say break a leg.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely not what I want to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why do we say that?
I know why we say that. It comes from show business.
Yeah.
And so break a leg, that's what we normally say to someone who's about to go and do a performance, right?
Yeah.
It's like, good luck for your show. Mm. And so it doesn't mean this actually, I learned this on the podcast from one of my guests, Ian Moore, who's a comedian who lives in France and he goes to London, he commutes. He told me this story. So It doesn't mean to break one of your legs. Actually, the leg refers to a limb. Okay, so a limb is another word for an arm or a leg. But also a limb can be a large piece of wood, like a beam. Okay, and mm-hmm. so limbs also would be like branches of a tree. We call them limbs as well.
Yeah.
So a large piece of wood can be a limb as well as an arm or a leg. And so in comedy, when you have a really good show, you raise the roof, right? The audience laugh and applaud so much that it's like the whole roof comes off the theatre or the building to raise the roof. And so break a leg means break a limb, meaning break one of the wooden beams in the roof, which basically means I hope you have such a good show that the roof comes off, that you break the roof off. So that's what break a leg means.
And people say English is a complicated language.
I know. It's so simple.
It's so simple, obviously.
So simple.
Well, thanks. I've learned something new today. That's good.
Right then. Now, what about all these idioms? Did you manage to identify three idioms that I used? And which idioms did you think were pre-planned? So tell me the ones that you heard and then tell me the ones that you think were pre-planned.
Right. I've only written down the ones that I think were pre-planned.
Okay.
And I only got two.
Oh, really?
So the first one I got was two sheets to the wind.
Two sheets to the wind was one I used, but was not planned. It was improvised. So, sorry, we're going to have to clarify what two sheets to the wind means. It was used in reference to the drunk Santa Claus who mistook your son for a girl.
Yes.
Maybe because he had been drinking. He was two sheets to the wind. So two sheets to the wind, it's just a fairly funny expression, I suppose, that means a little bit drunk. Does it mean a bit drunk or very drunk?
I think it means a little bit drunk because it came in the context of something that I said, which also meant the same thing, which perhaps you wrote down as one of my idioms.
I'll come back to that. So
we'll come back to that one.
Half cut. I wrote that one down.
Essentially, it means the same thing. Half cut, two sheets to the wind. But half cut wasn't one of my written down idioms.
Mm. Okay. Well, we've got... it just means drunk.
Yeah.
So it can be a little bit drunk or it's just drunk. So it's not an extreme, it doesn't mean extremely drunk. It just means drunk. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I wrote down, so you wrote down two sheets to the wind. I don't know why we say two sheets to the wind.
I don't know.
I can very briefly find out. Oh, I say very, very briefly. There is an explanation on the internet, but it's far too long for me to go into now, but I will link to it on the website on the page for this episode. So
the other one I got, and I'm fairly confident about this one, it was to pull the rug from under you.
That was improvised as well. Sorry,
you're good at this game.
Well, I actually found it really, really hard to insert my idioms in there. But to pull the rug from under someone's feet. No, that was improvised. Do you remember how that was used?
I can't remember.
I can't remember the context in which I used that one, to pull the rug from under someone. But it essentially means to... Oh, how would you describe what that means?
It means to do something that exposes someone or puts them in a difficult situation or leaves them... defenseless, if you like.
Yeah, so if you can imagine literally someone standing on a rug is like a carpet which you put in the middle of the room. So it's not attached. It's just a carpet that you can roll up or roll out onto the floor. And someone's standing on the rug and you pull the rug really quickly from under their feet, it would cause them to lose balance and maybe fall over. So if you can think of, you know, that expression when you do something else that causes someone to maybe, find themselves in a difficult situation or cause someone to have a problem, you could say you pulled the rug from under their feet. You made life suddenly very difficult and complicated for them. Yeah, but no, that wasn't one of the ones that I had pre-planned. Sorry.
So what were your three? Because I've got zero.
So my three were, one of them was to get the wrong end of the stick.
I don't remember you saying
so
that.
So I think this is what Santa, either Santa who...
Or Andy Johnson, or, the footballer.
Or maybe Andy Johnson, the footballer, he got the wrong end of the stick, thinking I was talking about you, and thinking I was talking about him, when actually I was talking about you, so he got the wrong end of the stick. Santa got the wrong end of the stick because he thought that your son was a girl.
Yeah,
and
so
also
he got confused.
The guy at Notting Hill Carnival got the wrong end of the stick because he thought that you looked like... Fat Boy Slim, when in fact it was Moby. Does that count as getting the wrong end of the stick? Basically, to misunderstand the situation is to get the wrong end of the stick.
So that was one. I missed that one.
The other one that I used was to be a dead ringer.
I don't remember you saying that either.
I must have subtly slipped it in there without you noticing. To be a dead ringer for someone. I think I said that you're a bit of a dead ringer for Moby.
For Moby. So people could probably work out what that means from the context. If you're a dead ringer for someone, you look very similar or you look alike.
Yeah, that's right. It's a nice one. A dead ringer for, to be a dead ringer for someone. It means you look exactly like that person. Apparently, according to Wikipedia, it means an exact duplicate. And it derives from the 19th century... from 19th century horse racing slang for a horse presented under a false name and pedigree. Okay. A ringer was a late 19th century term for a duplicate, usually with implications of dishonesty. And dead, in this case, means precise. For example, we say you're dead right, or it was in the dead center. So dead can mean precise or exactly right. So a dead ringer means an exact duplicate.
Okay.
So, but we'd say you are a dead ringer for someone. And then the third one that I used was to keep the wolf from the door. But you didn't hear that one either, did you?
I think I did.
We're talking about running the marathon.
Running the marathon when I got hungry, yeah.
I said, you know, what do you eat? Do you eat a full slap up breakfast or just a banana to keep the wolf from the door?
I remember now.
And to keep the wolf from the door, folks, it means when you eat something just to prevent yourself from getting too hungry. So it's not to have a full meal, but maybe in the afternoon, if you're feeling a bit peckish, feeling a bit hungry, you might have a little snack just to keep the wolf from the door, just to prevent yourself from getting too hungry. But it's not for when you eat a full meal. It's normally for when you have a little snack just to get rid of feelings of hunger until you can eat later on, to keep the wolf from the door. Okay.
All right. Well, I'm not very good at this game.
Well,
if this were a penalty shootout, you'd only need to score one to win now.
That's right, because you got nothing on that round there.
Out of three.
Yeah, zero out of three there. But let's see how I get on. Now, I'm 100% English, so if this is a penalty shootout, then don't get your hopes up.
You've got to get one right, or this is the worst game ever.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Okay, so I think you said it's the cross I bear. It's the cross I bear, meaning your resemblance to a certain music producer from the United States. It's the cross I bear. Was that one of the ones you had pre-planned?
Back of the net.
Yeah! Okay, yep. So I got one right. So what does that mean then? It's the cross I bear. It's not too difficult to explain, I suppose.
No, I guess it's biblical, isn't it? It relates to Jesus and having... When you say the cross I bear, it's like the burden that you have. It's something that you have to live with.
Uh-huh.
I was using it in a very kind of irreverent way, very lighthearted way.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that I'm often mistaken for Moby is the cross I bear. It's just something that you have to put up with and accept.
It's the burden that you carry through your life.
The burden that you carry through your life.
Evoking the story of Jesus where he carried the cross.
Absolutely.
And so, it's the cross I bear. Okay.
A lot of our idioms come from the Bible. It doesn't really say whether you're religious or not. A lot of our idioms, a lot of our language is influenced by the Bible.
Yeah, that's right. You know the Alanis Morissette?
Yeah.
What's that song? And I'm here to remind you of the mess you left when you went away. There's a misheard lyric with that song. She goes, I'm here to remind you of the cross I bear that you gave to me.
Yeah.
Right? And it sounds like she's singing the cross-eyed bear that you gave to me. I'm here to remind you of the cross-eyed bear that you gave to me. I always imagine that like her boyfriend gave her a partially sighted bear.
It probably explains why she's so angry.
Yeah, I'd be angry if I was left with a half blind bear. Like, what? This is no use to me.
Can't even watch TV with him.
No, he can't even go out and find honey. He can't see the honey. He can smell it, can't see it.
Driving him mad, he's getting really angry.
But it wasn't a cross-eyed bear. It was the cross-eyed bear that you gave to me. All right, that was the first one. The second one, I think, was actually the phrase half-cut.
Nope.
No?
That wasn't one.
Ah, damn. Missed. I just pitched that one way over the bar, didn't I?
Yeah.
I just did a crisp.
Chris Waddle. Italian 90.
Yeah. Half-cut. To be half-cut means drunk.
Yes,
to be
right.
Quite drunk. To be half-cut. Okay, and then we've got to slag someone off.
No, that wasn't it either. Was that the Twitter conversation? Because there was an idiom from the Twitter conversation.
In the Twitter conversation, you were talking about how people had abused you on Twitter, and you said that they slagged you off. To slag
someone
off.
You were very close. To slag someone off is to criticize them, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Or in quite insulting way. But actually, what I said during that conversation was my second idiom.
Yeah.
Which is, I said that when you stand on a pedestal.
Yes, I wrote it down, but I just thought it was one that you'd used on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
Stand on a pedestal.
Well, the actual idiom is to put someone or something up on a pedestal. And I guess what it means is when you, if you put someone on a pedestal, you think that they're amazing and you behave as though that person or object rather is perfect, extraordinarily wonderful or better than others. But the way I used it is to stand on a pedestal means to stand up in front of people and talk.
Yeah.
So you kind of expose yourself to criticism or any kind of reaction.
I guess we've got two expressions there then, really. We've got to put someone on a pedestal. And a pedestal is like something that you would use to present maybe like a very valuable statue or a very valuable vase or something like that. Like if you go to the Louvre, the museum, and you'll see, for example, old Greek or Roman statues, they're often presented on pedestals. Like the statue of David, for example, it's probably stands on a pedestal, I would expect. It's like a raised thing that allows you to see it. So if you put something on a pedestal, it's like saying this is a wonderful, amazing thing, putting someone on a pedestal. And for you, what you said was to stand on a pedestal. Yeah, exactly. To kind of put yourself in a position in front of everyone in which you're kind of exposed and you might get criticized maybe or something.
Well, I think there is a connection between them because even though you don't think you're amazing or anything like that, but if you're standing on a pedestal, it means that you are giving your opinions on something, which therefore suggests that you have something interesting to say.
Right.
So that, I think that's where the connection between the two comes. But you didn't get that one.
No, didn't get that one. What is that?
Yeah, no, there was one more, which I used it very near the beginning, and that was jaw-dropping, or to make your jaw drop.
I didn't get that one. I wrote down eye-opening. You said something was really eye-opening.
Yeah.
Like something that makes you realise something. Wow.
I think that was in the same... that was the same part of the conversation, I think, when we were talking about eye-opening and jaw-dropping. I can't remember what the context was now. I think it was... it might have been... the Twitter, it might have been when we're talking about kids' clothes. But yeah, jaw-dropping, it's just if you imagine that something is so astonishing or surprising that your mouth just hangs open. Yeah, exactly.
Your jaw, which is like the bottom part of your head.
Yeah.
Which your chin is attached to your jaw. Just your jaw opens like, what? Wow. Jaw-dropping. Okay, so we had to be a dead ringer for someone, to get the wrong end of the stick. What else? What was the other one? To keep the wolf from the door, to be half cut.
No, that wasn't one.
No. The cross eye bear.
Yeah.
To stand on a pedestal and jaw dropping. There we go, folks. You also said to cause a kerfuffle, which is like a kerfuffle is like a sort of a fuss or a difficult situation.
Yeah.
You said it's a minefield, meaning something that can cause you lots of problems.
Yeah, it's a very difficult area. It's like it's a very complicated topic. If it's a minefield, it's a very complicated topic.
You were talking about having socks with days of the week on them. It's a minefield because the potential for getting all the socks mixed up is very high. It's just going to cause you lots of problems. Like, oh, God, I've got like a Tuesday sock on my left foot and I've got a Friday sock on my right foot.
Nightmare.
This is a nightmare. And to slag off a whole generation, that's what you were accused of.
Yeah,
they were slagging you off for slagging off a whole generation.
To criticize a whole generation, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, this game, because for a native English speaker, you don't realize how often you use these. And you don't. They're very difficult to actually listen out for idioms because you're so conditioned to hear them. Mm. And it's only when you kind of telegraph it, if you like, you make it really clear that you're about to use an idiom. That's the only way you could kind of guess what it was. I found that very, very difficult.
And in a way, they work best when they are not fully telegraphed. I mean, they work best when they're not, when it's not that obvious that you've used it. And I find when you use an idiom in a very obvious way, like, hey, everybody, I'm using an idiom now.
It's raining cats and dogs outside.
Exactly. Well, it's certainly raining cats and dogs, isn't it, everybody? Somehow that feels a bit unnatural and a bit awkward and sort of cheesy. And it's really tricky for learners of English to get this right, because what you often meet, like, learners of English who have done really well and they've learnt loads of idioms, and then they just become like idiom machines.
Yeah. And then they begin to sound really unnatural as a result.
That's right. Idioms are tricky because they're best used sort of sparingly, I reckon. So when you do learn lots of idioms, don't try and fill every single conversation full of idioms, because you're going to sound a bit odd. But get a couple of them, get a couple of nice ones, and use them sparingly rather than all the time.
The thing about idioms, and I think I may have even said this on the podcast before, I can't remember, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. They're the part of language that's most directly related to culture.
Mm.
So every language has idioms of some form or another, but they're the kind of like the hardest thing to get right, because they're like, to give you an example, we say in English, we say I'm all at sea, I've got too much to do. I'm all at sea. I'm confused. I don't know where to start. And my mum, who's Swedish, she said, I'm sitting in the lake. And it's an idiom with the same, more or less the same meaning. And the reason they say that is, in England, or Britain rather, it's an island. So when we go to the water, we need to go to the sea. That's our nearest sort of stretch of water.
Yeah.
Whereas Sweden's called the land of 1,000 lakes or 10,000 lakes. So when you go swimming, you go to a lake rather than for many, many people.
Yeah.
And I was talking about this with my students once, and I got them all to think about whether they had that idiom in their own language. And one by one, they're like, oh, yeah, there's a guy from Saudi Arabia who goes, it means we say I'm lost in the desert.
Mm.
And it's amazing how you can tie it back to the culture of a place. It doesn't always work, but, you know, more often than not, the idioms will exist. It's just slightly different according to the culture that you're in.
That is very interesting. I wonder, just picking one idiom out, I wonder what the different versions around the world are of to keep the wolf from the door, because that's quite a nice one.
Mm.
Quite like, because it kind of tells a story, doesn't it, of, you know, the wolf in this case is your hunger, and you're trying to, you know, stop the wolf from getting in. And I wonder what people say about that. Do you have idioms around the world for ways of staving off hunger, like just having a little snack to keep the wolf from the door? What's the equivalent in your countries? I wonder if that reflects, you know, any differences in the culture or things like the wildlife or whatever. Interesting stuff, Andy. Thank you so much for talking to me on the podcast again.
You're very welcome.
Good luck again for the marathon in April.
Thanks. Yeah.
And speak to you again soon, I hope.
Cool. Yeah, maybe I'll check. Maybe I'll talk to you after the marathon, perhaps.
Yes, that would be good. You can give us a little report on what happened and how it went, and I'd love to know. I'd like to have like a mile by mile account.
I'll run with a microphone and just it will be fine for the first few miles. It'll be quite interesting, but then it'll just be me. Yeah, exactly. Why did I do this? Yeah, so the law of diminishing returns there.
Yes, I think so. Okay, well, anyway, we look forward to hearing about the whole thing later on at some point.
Great, thanks very much for having me.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Cheers, Luke. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
English.
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 Yes.
English.
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 English, dude.
English.
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 Plain English, creep.
Speak English.
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 I'm speaking in English.
So there you go. That was my chat with Andy Johnson with the idioms game in there too. Lots of nice language to be learned and some good listening practice as well. Now, if you would like to sponsor Andy and help to support the work of the Christie Foundation Trust and the good things that they're doing, you can if you want to. And you'll find a link on the page for this episode on my website that will take you to Andy's Just Giving page. It's justgiving.com/fundraising/AndyBJohnson. But check the page for this episode. You'll see the link if you would like to support Andy in his marathon and give some money to the Christie Foundation Trust. Okay. Now then, you heard us at the end there going through some of the idioms that we thought the other one had pre-planned. And in fact, the ones that we had pre-planned, and you got like expressions like two sheets to the wind, to pull the rug from under you, to get the wrong end of the stick, to be a dead ringer for someone, to keep the wolf from the door, it's the cross I bear, to be half cut and to slag someone off, and also to stand on a pedestal, to put someone on a pedestal, and to be jaw-dropping. So you've already heard us explaining some of those things and talking about them a little bit more. I want to just wrap things up here at the end by explaining more of the idiomatic expressions that popped up in this conversation in part two that haven't been explained yet, and also some other nice bits of vocab. So this is where we focus on language that you heard in that conversation, but you might not have either you might not have noticed the phrases, or maybe you don't know what the phrases mean, or maybe you notice them, but you know, it would be nice to just have a nice little reminder for some of those things. So I've made another list here of phrases, idioms, and other nice bits of language. I'm going to go through it now. You'll see this list on the page for the episode. This list does contain the other expressions that Andy and I talked about at the end of the conversation there, but a lot more too. So if I'm repeating myself here, I do apologise, but I think also it's probably quite good to just reinforce, you know, the language for you a bit more. So we'll start with the expression a dead ringer, which is something I actually forgot to mention. It came up in part one, I think, when I said that Andy was a bit of a dead ringer for Moby, which is, you know, we keep going on about this. But a dead ringer. You actually heard me explain it, I think. A dead ringer is just someone who looks exactly like someone else. So to be a dead ringer for someone means that you look exactly like someone else. Next thing is, I said they'd all got the wrong end of the stick, but they were all slagging you off. To get the wrong end of the stick means to just misunderstand the situation. I think you got the wrong end of the stick. No, that's not what I'm saying. You got the wrong end of the stick, mate. All right. And then to slag you off. Well, I think I did that one in the last episode. Slagging someone off means to criticize someone in a rude way. Next, we had it was really eye opening to how quickly it can escalate and how people can latch on to something and they can completely turn it and twist it. So Andy there is talking about how when people sort of get a certain idea about something, you know, when they've just received a small piece of information, they immediately latch onto it and sort of turn it and twist it, and the situation escalates and suddenly gets more and more serious and out of control. So this is how, for example, sometimes things kind of go wrong on Twitter. So you might find that a celebrity writes a tweet
And it's not meant to be taken too seriously, but then people maybe take it on face value and they find it offensive. And then it sort of snowballs into a much bigger thing. And then before you know it, like a lot of people are giving this person loads of abuse, and it's like really unbalanced and unfair and actually very damaging and not really proper justice. So, you know, that's what Andy was talking about. It's really eye-opening to see that. If something's eye-opening, as I said before, it's surprising and it's something that you can learn from. It's like, wow, like it's surprising and you learn something new from it. And also jaw-dropping as well. If something's jaw-dropping, it's kind of amazing or astonishing, as we said before. But also you've got the expression there, people can latch onto something. To latch onto something, L-A-T-C-H, means to become firmly attached to something, and it could be physically or it could be like non-physically as well. So physically, to become firmly attached to something. Actually, most doors have a latch on the door. So when you close the door, click, you know, when it goes click, that's the latch clicking into place. So, you know, that's a physical latch, which allows the door to become physically firmly attached to the door frame so that it doesn't open. The door becomes latched to the wall, for example. But also in other senses, you can latch onto something. So it could be for an idea. So people can latch onto an idea. And if they latch onto an idea, it means they strongly accept an idea with enthusiasm. They just kind of get fixed on one idea very quickly and firmly. Like, for example, if they get, you know, in Andy's case, they thought that he was saying, they thought he was criticizing millennials. He wasn't. He was just reporting what other people had said about them. But people got the wrong end of the stick. And they suddenly latched onto this idea that Andy was like this anti-millennial guy, and then the floodgates opened and they just kind of, there was lots of abusive tweeting in his direction, you see, because lots of people just latched onto this idea. They got quickly fixed on this idea. I think I said, how did it feel to receive all of that heavy-handed criticism? Okay, so heavy-handed is an adjective. And heavy-handed means that it's too strong or using too much force than is using more force than is necessary. For example, you might talk about heavy-handed policing. The police were a bit heavy-handed in the way that they dealt with the demonstration. That there was, like, let's say, a public demonstration in the street. Let's say young people had taken to the street and they were demonstrating against the government or something, and the police came out to try and keep the crowd of people under control, and they got a bit heavy-handed and they ended up sort of hitting some of the protesters, and there was violence and it became quite ugly because the police were very heavy-handed. Similarly, I said about the abuse or criticism that Andy had received on Twitter, that it was all a bit heavy-handed, like it was all a bit too strong, really, using more force than was necessary. Heavy-handed criticism. Next thing is, I think Andy said this, he said, I sent the guy a message, the guy whose tweet caused the kerfuffle. A kerfuffle. It's a nice word. A kerfuffle. K-E-R-F-U-F-F-L-E. A kerfuffle is basically a disturbance, like a fuss. Could be a noise or could just be a confusing and complex situation. For example, if you send an email to all the people in your office, and the email contains something controversial, or maybe you're criticizing someone and everyone gets a bit angry and it causes a kind of a bit of a conflict and there's a fuss and everyone's talking about it, it caused a kerfuffle. For example, she caused quite a kerfuffle when she sent out that letter accusing them of cheating. Or maybe it could be like you're in a restaurant and you've ordered food and the food is not how you like it. Maybe there's a fly in the, there's an insect in the food or something, and you complain very loudly and you cause a big kerfuffle, and, you know, the waiters come out and they all apologize and all the other people in the restaurant are looking over. Oh, what's going on over there, darling? You know, there was a big kerfuffle. Okay, fine. Next thing is, Andy said, I was thanking him for sticking up for me. I think he was talking about the guy who wrote the original tweet that caused the misunderstanding. And apparently Andy noted that this guy was actually sticking up for Andy. So to stick up for someone means to defend someone or to back someone up. Okay? Like, for example, like, I know, I'll stick up for you. I'll stick up for you, meaning I'll defend you. Like, they all disagree with you, but, you know, don't worry, I'll stick up for you. I've got your back. I'll back you up. I'll defend you. I'll stick up for you. To stick up for someone. Okay? Remember, you can see all of the stuff that I'm saying, all the list of all of the expressions and stuff, you can see it all on the page for this episode if you want to make a note of these things. Next one, Andy, I think, said, if you stand on a pedestal and give your opinion on things, you're always setting yourself up for people to have a go at you. So we talked about to stand on a pedestal, okay? That means to you know, not literally stand on a pedestal. A pedestal would be like a raised platform. Like, for example, in a museum, you might have an old Roman statue would probably stand on a pedestal. So it's like a raised platform for displaying something. So if you stand on a pedestal, it doesn't mean literally standing on a pedestal. That's why it's an idiom. It means to just put yourself in a position, like a visible position where other people can see you and maybe criticize you or whatever. In Andy's case, he was doing a presentation that was being live tweeted. So to stand on a pedestal is to put yourself in a position in front of everyone. And I said, Andy said, if you stand on a pedestal and you give your opinion on things, you're always setting yourself up for people to have a go at you. If you set yourself up for something, you put yourself in a position where something can happen. Okay, set yourself up for success, which means, you know, put yourself in the right position in which success can happen to you. Okay, for example, setting yourself up for success could involve working hard or getting into the right, getting the right qualifications or meeting the right people, putting yourself in the right position in which success can happen, setting yourself up for success. You could set yourself up for a fall, you know, like if you see someone and you look at their behavior and you think, oh dear, that person is going to fail or something bad is going to happen to that person, you could say, you know, I just think you're setting yourself up for a fall. Like, for example, someone who, is going to give a public presentation about a dodgy topic. What was the one from the previous episode? Going to give a talk to a Catholic girls' convent school about contraception or something. It was a slightly dodgy example. Maybe I shouldn't mention that one again. I wouldn't want to set myself up for a fall. Hey, there you go. I don't know. Like if you're going to publicly, I'm trying to think of a good example of set yourself up for a fall. Right, here's one. Imagine your friend has managed to convince a girl to go on a date with him. Okay, now he is absolutely obsessed with this girl. He's in love with her. She isn't really in love with him. In fact, she's way out of his league. She's much prettier, probably much more intelligent, basically just much too good for him, frankly. You wouldn't say that to him, of course, because that would make him feel bad. But I mean, you know, she's out of his league. And he's completely obsessed by her, and he somehow has managed to persuade her to go on a date with him. Maybe she doesn't realize it's a date, and he is now building himself up. He's setting himself up as if this is the beginning of, you know, a proper relationship with this girl, and that, you know, this is it, and they're going to get married, you know. So he's like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I've been waiting for this moment for so long. It's going to be so great. I don't know why he became Donald Trump. It's going to be so great. I've been waiting for this situation for totally ages. I'm going to be president. It's going to be a huge success. Believe me, folks, I know about being president. I've been watching Barack Obama. He's terrible. Okay, he's the worst president in presidential history. I'm going to be a lot more popular. My ratings are going to go through the roof. Okay, I'm going to be the greatest president ever in the whole world. And, you know, Trump's friend would be like, careful, because, you know, you might be setting yourself up for a fall there. You know, believe me, the world is going to love Trump. I am going to make America great again in the eyes of the world. And, you know, just steady on there, Donald. You know, don't set yourself up for a fall. Thing is with Donald Trump that you could probably never convince him that he'd had a fall. Even if he had literally fallen over, if he'd fallen off a horse, and he's literally broken his back, and he's lying in the mud on the floor with a broken back, and you're like, Donald, you've fallen off a horse. I've not, you know, this is great. This is fake news. I have not fallen off a horse. Yes, the impression went a bit wrong there. It's fake news, folks. It's sad. I totally chose to be here. This is great mud, believe me. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking this mud is dirty. It's disgusting. This is American soil. I love my country. You know, anyway, so this guy, going back to this friend of yours who has convinced himself that this girl who's way out of his league is going to fall in love with him. And you're like, mate, you know, don't worry. You're going to get I'm worried about Dave. He's going to get his heart broken. He's setting himself up for a fall here. Okay. That's to set yourself up for a fall. What about to set yourself up for people to have a go at you? This is what Andy did. You know, he put himself on a pedestal. He set himself up for people to have a go at him. He put himself in a position where people could criticize him, you see. And then we talked about doing stand-up. And Andy was like, what about when you do stand-up? You're literally standing on stage. And so you're setting yourself up for a fall, potentially. You're setting yourself up for criticism. Yeah, and then that's when we talked about heckling. People in the audience might heckle you, meaning kind of publicly criticize you, like, oh, you're rubbish, tell us a joke, come on, that sort of thing. All right, I'll come back to heckling. Anyway, that was to set yourself up for something. You could set yourself up for success or set yourself up for a fall. Okay. Also, we had to stand on a pedestal. We also had to put something on a pedestal or put someone on a pedestal. If you put someone on a pedestal, it means you admire or respect someone so much that you think they're perfect, or you idolize them, or you idealize them. So they're like, you know, untouchable and perfect. Like, you know, I imagine some of the voters in the United States. I mean, well, bit of politics, watch out. But I think it's probably true. I mean, it's not just for Donald Trump. It could be for anyone. That there's always like a new candidate who comes along and they speak in the right way to certain people. And those people then put that person up on a pedestal. And they're like, I love Trump. I think he's great. He's going to make America great again. And it's like, well, what about all of the criticism that people have leveled at him that, you know, he's a misogynist and that all these other things, which I'm not really going to go into now because I don't want to get into the politics. But, you know, he's faced a lot of criticism, like the fact that he doesn't really know what he's doing and that he doesn't really care. And in fact, you know, some people have said that he's in fact incompetent and that there's, you know, allegations of corruption there as well. And the person would be like, you know, I think it's all fake news. I think that the mainstream media are just making all this stuff up about him. They just need to leave him alone. He's going to make America great again. And they're just like, well, you know, I think that you're just sort of putting him up on a pedestal, really. Okay, to put someone on a pedestal. Similarly, Dave, with this girl, he's put her up on a pedestal as well. It's like, she's like the perfect girl. It's like a British Donald Trump. Believe me, she's the perfect girl. If Trump had a British accent, what would that be like? Believe me, folks, I'm going to make Britain great again. He's become Michael Caine. Believe me, I'm going to make Britain great again. This is a bloody great country. I'm going to make it great again. And if you don't believe me, then you can sit down and shut your mouth. You're only supposed to make this country great again. All right, leave it, Luke. Okay, I'll leave it then. Anyway, to put someone on a pedestal. Next thing is, people react quite strongly to that, especially when it's posing some kind of threat to the status quo of their work. So to pose a threat to something, it's not really an idiom, but it's a nice expression. It's a collocation, really, to pose a threat. If something poses a threat to something, it means that it is a threat, or to present a possible danger to something. Like, for example, carbon emissions pose a significant threat to global warming. It's totally fake news, people. It's fake news. global warming, it's a total myth. Okay, Donald, all right, that's your opinion. It's not just an opinion. It's a fact, 100% verifiable fact. All right. Can you just go away, Donald Trump, for a bit? Thanks. Not for political reasons, but just because the impression is not... Anyway. Maybe I should just bring Arnold Schwarzenegger back in and that'll make... Oh, no, there you go, fine. Okay, that's a quick Arnold Schwarzenegger impression, like the mini impressions. They're quite fun. Arnold Schwarzenegger impression, mini one. Oh, anyone can do it. Donald Trump mini impression. Believe me, folks, I'm going to make it, you know, just say everything's great. With Donald Trump, you just say it's totally great. It's the greatest thing ever. And believe me, I know. That's how you do it. Like, pick a thing. Like, you've got an apple. You're about to eat an apple. It's totally the greatest fruit. It's the first fruit. It's the first word in the alphabet, the apple. It's the best fruit, especially American apples. Believe me, folks, I know fruit. Obama, like the quick Obama impression. You just have to say the words today very quickly and then leave a long pause after it. So let's say it's today I'm going to eat an apple. You have to go, today. And that's it. I told you, it's a short impression. Today. Okay. Back to the idioms and stuff. To pose a threat to something. The status quo. The status quo is means the present situation. It's not just that rock and roll band that you've probably never heard of, and so it's probably not worth me mentioning it. The status quo means the present situation. We were talking about if something poses a threat to the status quo of your work. So we're talking about some teachers, they see technology as posing a threat to the status quo of their work. So the technology, to an extent, for some teachers, makes them feel vulnerable or makes them feel like their work is changing, like the status quo of their work, the current situation of their work is changing. It's like, and they suddenly have to start dealing with all this new technology, and it's changing the marketplace as a teacher. And some people don't like that. Okay. People might feel like these new things are pulling the rug from under them. I did explain that before, I think. It's like pulling the rug from under their feet. So to pull the rug from under someone means to suddenly take away support or help from someone. Imagine you're standing there on a rug and someone suddenly pulls it away. Suddenly the ground underneath you is unstable and you might fall on the ground. So it's to suddenly do something that causes problems for people. Whip the rug or pull the rug from under your feet. Whoa! Heckling. There we go. Heckling. So this is when someone in the audience starts shouting out things when someone is speaking publicly. So it happens in stand-up comedy. You'll be up there. If it's a difficult crowd, if they're an aggressive audience, which happens sometimes, you might be trying to tell your jokes and someone in the audience will be like, you know, like, get a haircut, or I don't know what it would be. It's just the random example. Okay. Like, tell us a joke. That's usually the tough one, because you're there telling jokes and they go, come on, mate, tell us a joke. And you're like, but I have been telling you jokes. Oh, I see. It was an insult. What else? I got an injury and it got worse and worse and worse throughout the week. This is what Andy said. I couldn't run for 5 weeks. I had physio. I had acupuncture, I had ultrasound. So these aren't idioms, but you know what acupuncture is, but I had physio. Physio, to have physio, that's physiotherapy. That's when, you know, you've got a physical injury, let's say a leg injury, and they do certain things to help the leg to get better, like maybe bending the leg or massaging the muscle or whatever. That's physiotherapy. Physio for short, to have physio. And ultrasound, well, ultrasound, that's an ultrasound scan. That's a sort of a scan that uses sound as a way of seeing inside your body as an alternative to an x-ray. To check for an injury or maybe a baby, like when a woman is pregnant, she'll go for an ultrasound scan, and that's how they can actually get images of the baby, and they can kind of, you know, check out the baby and see if it's all right and stuff. So, yeah, it's an alternative to an x-ray to check for an injury or maybe a baby, but not a baby in Andy's case. That's not why he had an ultrasound scan. That would have been strange, wouldn't it? Like if Andy had gone for an ultrasound and they like discovered a baby in his leg, that would have been weird. Like, so what seems to be the problem, Mr. Johnson? Well, my knee is playing up. It's very stiff and painful when I walk. I think I did it when I was running. And the physio goes, well, let's just have a look. If you'd like to just lie down here, we'll start the ultrasound. Oh, Mr. Johnson, it appears that you're pregnant.
What?
Yes, that's right. You have a baby in your knee. But how is this possible? I've been using contraception. Ha ha ha, etc. Let's move on. The physio used to be the physiotherapist for Fulham Football Club. So we had to have physio and also the physio. So the physio can also be the person, the physiotherapist. Okay, so a physio, meaning a physiotherapist, and to have physio, meaning physiotherapy. And Andy said, when I walked in, he did a double take, thinking that Andy might be the other Andy Johnson, who used to play football for Fulham Football Club, which is a club based in London. So to do a double take, that's the expression I'm looking at here. And this is a nice one. A double take is always funny. It's always funny when you see someone doing a double take. That's when you look at something briefly, like quickly just look at something, and then you look away, and then look back again immediately, very quickly, because you're surprised. So you're kind of looking around, right? So you look at something and then it doesn't register, you look away, and then you look back again really quickly. You know what I mean? Like, it's very hard for me to do it here because obviously there's no visual element, but you can imagine me kind of going like a... And you can also do a triple take, which is like three. Your head goes back and forth a couple of times before the thing actually registers. And you could also do a quadruple take for maximum comic effect, which would be... Okay. All right. That's a double take. To do a double take. Andy said... we were just joking around, and Andy said, he's a bit of a mover and shaker in the world of football, this Luke Thompson. So if you are a mover and shaker in the world of something, typically it's followed by in the world of, like, he's a mover and shaker in the world of films. He's a mover and shaker in the world of TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language. He's a bit of a mover and shaker in the world of professional football. So a mover and shaker is a powerful person who influences people and initiates events. All right. Okay, I need to hurry up a bit. So, any little problem gets exacerbated when you're running a marathon, said Andy, talking about his injury. So, to exacerbate something, or if something gets exacerbated, it means it's made worse, or it means to make something worse. It's not really an idiom, but there it is. So, you know, I've got a bit of an injury in my leg, and, you know, running has really exacerbated the injury. It's made it worse. Moving on. It seems to be, so Andy was talking about his leg again, it seems to be, touch wood, it seems to be okay. So people say touch wood as a superstition to wish themselves luck or for protection against bad luck. It's like saying fingers crossed, so touch wood. It's like, yeah, you know, it's not raining, hopefully it won't be raining this afternoon, touch wood. Okay, it's a way of sort of wishing yourself good luck. And I said, do you have a full slap-up breakfast? Or is it just a banana to keep the wolf from the door? So a slap-up breakfast. Slap-up, it's an adjective and it's used before a meal. And it means an excellent meal or first-class meal. For example, a slap-up meal or a slap-up breakfast. It's usually used in an enthusiastic and informal way to talk about a really good full meal. A big slap-up breakfast. Yum, yum, yum. And also, to keep the wolf from the door... this means to eat just enough to prevent hunger, just to stave off hunger. To stave off hunger. So, for example, you might say, well, you know, it's not lunchtime yet, but I'm just going to have a banana to keep the wolf from the door. Do you want to take a banana just to keep the wolf from the door? For example. Next thing is... Andy said, you go out too fast at the beginning of a marathon. So after 6 or 7 kilometres, you're knackered. Knackered is actually spelt with a K, K-N-A-C-K-E-R-E-D, but the K at the start is silent. So it's not knackered, it's knackered. Okay, and knackered is British English slang, and it means extremely tired. Like, oh God, I'm knackered. Okay, everyone's in the same boat. They've trained for ages. There's music and the camaraderie. They're running together. Everybody just goes off far too quickly. Everyone's in the same boat. If you're in the same boat, it means you're in the same situation as someone else. Okay, like for example, you know, I'm trying to get 7 on my IELTS exam, and at the moment I'm stuck at 6.5, and it's like, yeah, me too. All right, so we're in the same boat. Okay, so you're in the same situation. Normally, I think it's normally a difficult situation when you say in the same boat. Okay, like when you're both in a difficult situation, we're in the same boat. The charity is something that's very close to my heart. This is Andy talking about the Christie Foundation Trust. If something is very close to your heart, it means it's very important to you. It means a lot to you. It's emotionally very important to you. Okay. And when you're wishing someone luck, as you may know, we say break a leg, often before a performance, like if before a presentation or something, you would say, come on, good luck, break a leg. It means have a good show. And I explained that a leg in this case refers to a limb, L-I-M-B, that's limb. A limb is an arm or a leg, but it also can mean a large piece of wood, like a beam. A beam is used in constructing a building, like a large piece of wood for constructing a building. You might have beams in the ceiling of your house. You know, be careful not to hit your head on the low beams. But a limb can also be the branch of a tree. So it's just a large piece of wood can be a limb. That's why we say break a leg, because in comedy, when you have a really good show, you raise the roof. That means the roof comes off because the audience are laughing and applauding so much. You raise the roof and you might actually break the roof. You might break one of the beams in the roof. You break a limb or you break a leg. So break a leg means I hope you have such a great show that the roof comes off the building. And someone said this, I don't know who it was. Someone said, I was using it in a very irreverent way, a very light-hearted way. So irreverent just means light-hearted. It's another word for light-hearted, irreverent. Not irrelevant, irrelevant means not important or not significant or not relevant. But irreverent, no L, irreverent means light-hearted. Okay, watch out for that. We were talking about the expression, it's the cross I bear. Yes, the cross. Andy was saying it. He didn't mean any offence when he was saying, when we were talking about the expression, it's the cross I bear. In English, we do use that phrase, it's the cross I bear, meaning it's like a burden that you carry in your life. Like in Andy's case, he looks a bit like Moby, but I think we're really overstating that at this point. What's the cross I bear? The cross I bear is that I just can't be brief, that I ramble. It's the cross I bear. So anyway, and the final one is I'm all at sea. If you're all at sea, it means you're confused and you're not sure what to do. And we talked about how I'm all at sea might mean different, you know, there might be different equivalents in different places. And because in the UK, we are a seafaring nation because we're an island surrounded by water, that I'm all at sea is a phrase that we might use. But in other places where, you know, the geography is different, you might have different expressions. Like, for example, I'm in the desert. I'm lost in the desert. Okay, so that's the vocab. And there you go. Come on, people. That must be useful for you. A huge slice of English learning cake there for you to feast upon. You could feed a whole family on that for about a week in some places, I reckon. So again, I'd just like to mention, like I did in the last episode at this point, what do you think of this idea of this paid membership, premium membership system I'm talking about? Here's the plan, right? You could sign up to be a premium member of Luke's English Podcast for a nominal amount per month, or maybe per 6 months or per year. You'd get access to a certain number of language-related episodes of LEPP, that's LEP Premium, per month. The episodes would be available in the app or on a website. Episodes would mostly deal with language that has come up naturally in conversations on Luke's English Podcast, like what I've done here, or the recent grammar episodes that I've done. Yes, and remember that I did upload this part two of the grammar episode. It was called Grammar Questions. I uploaded part two of that into the app. So if you haven't got the app yet, that maybe there's some incentive to go and get it, that part two of the Grammar Questions episode is up there in the app for the app users.
So the premium idea, yes, you'd get a certain number of language-focused episodes, language-related, but with the usual funny examples and explanations and things. Also, there would be more phrasal verb episodes. I'd continue the phrasal verb series for the LEPP premium people. And probably other things, because I would want to reward my premium Lepsters, or Plepsters, as they could be called. So I'd probably offer little videos and other things too, all for the price of a beer or a sandwich for me per month. That's something that's just in the pipeline at the moment. Now, you might be thinking, well, why aren't you doing it now, Luke? Why can't I sign up for that now? Well, good question. I've been talking about this sort of thing for ages, haven't I? I have. It's slightly harder than you might think to implement this stuff, especially when I'm, you know, the usual story of balancing everything else in my life and all that stuff. The thing is, that, as well, I really want this to work. And if I was to start a new thing like that, I'd really want it to work. I wouldn't want to just start something that would be half-baked. I want it to be worthwhile. I want it to work. So I'm not going to start it until I'm sort of in a position where I feel like, yeah, that could work. That's something I could keep doing and that people would be interested in and that would be worth doing, you know, because I wouldn't want to like spend all my time on it and have no benefit from it, you know. I want it to be profitable for me. Because doing all this language analysis stuff is great and everything, but it does take quite a lot of time. I want to be able to make sure that my time is not being wasted and that, frankly, that I can get paid to do this, because, you know, why should I be doing it for free? I mean, I can't justify that. So anyway, it takes a while before I'm in a position where I can be like, yeah, actually, that will work. And then, all right, let's do it. You know, so enthusiastic responses from you would certainly give me a boost. I think it would be really great, don't you? I just hope that you realize that too. Anyway, you can contact me about it, if you like, using the usual methods of contact. And just before we go, let me remind you to join the mailing list so you get emails in your inbox when new stuff has been uploaded. Download the Luke's English Podcast app so that you can get the app-only episodes and that you'll be in the right place when the premium stuff drops, if and when it does. And finally, nice one for getting to the end of this episode. Quite long, as my episodes are, but, you know, that's what it's all about. Long-term, listening for longer periods of time, listening regularly. Imagine all that English that's gone into your brain. That's good. That's very good. It's totally great. It's totally terrific. Nice one. Give yourself a pat on the back. Well done, you, for being good to your English. I think you can agree that your English is now better than it was before you started listening to this, can't you? I mean, how could it be worse than it was before? It can only be better than it was before you started listening to this, right? I think you can agree with that statement. Yes. Okay, time to go now. Speak to you again soon on the podcast. But for now, goodbye. Bye. 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 Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.